Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? This is Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. This is your show. It's your show, people. Those of you who listen, it's yours. It's mine, but, you know, I share it with you. If I didn't do that, what would it be? Just me talking to myself and inviting people over to get me out of my head. So it's your show. And today I talked to Dan Soder, the comic, funny guy, good guy, big personality, talks what he knows. And I don't think we'd ever really, we never really met. Maybe we had briefly, but this is the first time we've talked. He has an HBO special called Dan Soder, Son of Gary. It was from 2019. It's sort of what got me locked into what he does. And, he's funny, and he's going to be on the show today. So, look, let's get a few things out of the way, because I mentioned a restaurant I go to here in Glendale quite often, because I think it's great. It's basically Middle Eastern food, but I said it was Persian, and it's not. It's Lebanese. That place is Scaff's. It's over on Verdugo. And the last time I was in there, they had heard I mentioned it. And now, of course, I feel bad, because I said it was Persian. I'm not even sure what Persian food is, to be honest with you. It's probably somewhat similar, but it's Lebanese, and it's the stuff. You know, they've got the falafel, they got the baba, the hummus, tahini. They've got they make a great fool, the cabbage salad, and the meats. That's not my bag anymore, right? I just want to straighten that out. Not Persian, Lebanese, Scaff's. There you go. Tickets go on sale for my 2024 tour this week. Here's where I'll be coming from January through June. San Diego, San Francisco, Portland, Maine, Boston, Providence, Rhode Island, Tarrytown, New York, Atlanta, Madison, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Chicago, Minneapolis, Montclair, New Jersey, Philly, Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit, Charleston, South Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina, Vancouver, and Seattle. There's a pre-sale that starts this Wednesday, November 1st at 10 a.m. local time for each venue. The password is all in. One word, all in. The general on sale date is Friday, November 3rd at 10 a.m. local time. Go to WTFpod.com/tour starting Wednesday for links to all the dates and venues. Couple of ongoing stories. On Saturday night, I was honored at a grief support organization. I was honored by Our House Grief Support Center, which is an amazing organization that provides grief support for families and for individuals at all levels of grief, throughout grief. And I was honored this year at their gala, and I was given the Good Grief Award for my work in publicly talking about grief on both the podcast and obviously my last special. And it was interesting for me, because I didn't know about this organization when Lynn died. I had no idea, and I kind of hammered away at it myself in the way that I thought one does. And it was during COVID, as some of you know. And unfortunately, after she passed, it was hard to be with people. There was no memorials. There was no, you know, there were some Zoom Shiva type of things. And, you know, a lot of people reached out. I felt supported, certainly, but it was it was difficult, and had I known about this organization, maybe I would have sought it out, because it is something that that happens to everybody, and it's something that if you don't process thoroughly or process at all, it could bring you down from the inside. But I thought it was kind of interesting that I was being honored for being hilariously sad at a grief support organization. And I think I could probably look at this as a lifetime achievement award, because if you look at it properly, and I think it's not that big a stretch, I think I've been hilariously sad my entire career. So I'm going to look at it as a lifetime achievement award, the Good Grief Award from our house. If you want to donate to them, you can check it out. It's ourhouse-grief.org. If you could use their services or would like to support their mission, which is really to support people, individuals and families in all stages of grief. And it was amazing. Now, you know, not to like, I want to make sure I frame this properly, because it was a first in my comedy career, because I knew I had to go up, accept the award, say some nice things, but also I'm a comedian. So I believed I was expected to do a little bit of jokes. And, you know, those kind of gala things where people are eating, big round tables, not an easy gig. But I knew I needed to drop a couple of jokes. And I'm being totally honest with you, this is a first, that before I went on, you know, there was many sort of speakers and some honors throughout the night. And then there was dinner. And then they brought up a mom and her three children who had lost a husband and a father to talk about the center. And then me. So It was probably the heaviest transition I've had to deal with in my career, but a powerful evening nonetheless. So moving on, right into it, the refrigerator problem. As many of you know, it's been a while that I've been struggling with the ice maker in an old fridge. I had my Alex, the Ukrainian fridge repair guy, over here on and off for what seems like a year. There was passionate displays of anger and frustration. He came over with his son. He yelled that he hated my fridge. His son said, fucking Murphy's Law. But, you know, Alex had me pretty convinced that it was his destiny and his quest in life to fix my freezer. But then, you know, it was hard to get him over. It was hard to get in touch with him. And, you know, it started to feel like a relationship I didn't necessarily want to be in. So I ordered a fridge about a month ago. It's basically the same fridge, just new. And it makes beautiful ice, beautiful little cubes of ice with a big, beautiful tray. I mean, I was willing to fight this fight with Alex, but then I lost my will. I ordered the new fridge. They took the other one out. Did not mind. I was happy to see that fucking thing go. And I'd like to believe Alex might have been too on some level. I didn't know what to say to Alex, so I just sent him a video of me opening the fridge and the freezer, showing him the ice, and I just texted, "It's over. We tried." I've not heard back from him. I'm sure he got the message. That's where I'm at with this thing. Other things that are happening. Halloween is happening. I've bought so much candy because last year I was inundated with kids of all ages, probably some in college, not even wearing costumes, but that happens. You know, why not if you can get away with it? So I got a lot of candy. I think we'll carve some pumpkins tomorrow. And on Tuesday, just be there. I just got to be careful not to, because I feel bad. You know, I'm innately codependent. And, you know, I just start to throw too much candy in. And they just stand there with their outfits and their parents. And if you give one two, you got to give the other two. If you give one three, you got to be a little shit. And then all of a sudden, I'm throwing all the candy into two bags. And then I'm out of candy for when the slightly buzzed grown-up kids come to pillage, which is fine if I don't have candy for them. But we're all set for that. I guess I should tell you, I just got out of Killers of the Flower Moon. We found the day to do it. We went. We locked in. IMAX, baby. Fuck, that's the only way to see a movie. And it really is great to go to the movies. And I think in this time of decline, that the communal feeling of being in a movie theater, even if you don't like the other people, you know, it's just, you know, people were wondering, and obviously there's been a lot of press on this, you know, between Oppenheimer and Barbie and just the return to the theaters, the Taylor Swift movie. But there is something great about it, of having to witness with a bunch of strangers. the difference between, you know, what you do at home while you watch a movie or the impact it has on you, to walk out, even just, you know, side glancing people after a movie that was powerful, like that movie was, it makes a big difference. It's a shared humanity. It's a shared bit of receiving profound storytelling, and it does mean something. It is different. It is vital. It really is. Going to the movies, and I've been doing a lot of it lately. I know my producer, Brendan, goes frequently, and it's something humans have been doing when the world seems like it has been ending forever, not just for entertainment, but, again, for respite and for a little distraction. But, you know, if it's a heavy movie and it's got things to say and the feels that it makes you have are important human feels to have in the context of what we're going through in our world today, even deeper, even better, more than just a distraction. Art, baby, art. But that IMAX thing, it's just the size the screen should be, like back in the old days. That's the fucking movie screen. It's supposed to be that big. I don't know if I need the chairs rumbling, but it's a real movie experience. And this one, the one we went to, has the reclining seats. So it was nice. It was nice. I didn't even want popcorn. I ate a lot of popcorn. Doesn't matter. But the movie is spectacular. How is it not going to be? You know, obviously DiCaprio is amazing. De Niro is great. But Lily Gladstone fucking carries that movie, man. And I knew when I saw her in Certain Women, that Kelly Reichardt movie, wow, I knew. I was like, who the fuck is that? And now she is in the, you know, the biggest movie of the year, probably, I think, in terms of weight. And she was amazing. And also several WTF guests, obviously. It seems that's the way with any movie now. But I was surprised that the musicians in the movie did so fucking well. Jason Isbell is in the movie. He's got a pretty big part. And he holds his own, man. He's there with fucking DiCaprio, and he does the thing. Sturgill Simpson is in it. Great. Holds his own with De Niro. Great. Jack White held the screen well. Very impressive. Pat Healy, who always does these smaller parts in these movies that are either, you know, old-timey set in the West or relatively new-timey set in the West. And he's always good. I'm going to text him. And speaking of people on the show, Nate Bargatze hosted SNL the other night and did very well. I'm saying this with pride and excitement for people I know kind of well and people I know not so well that I've talked to. And also just to counter my own sort of you know, lingering sense that I am not as popular as them. That's all right. But, you know, that's not taking over. Right now, it's the other thing that's taking over. It's the happy for the people I know thing. Listen to me living it. It's not always there. All right. So, look, here's where we're at now. We're at Dan Soder time. Again, this is the first time we ever really talked. He's out on tour right now through the end of the year. You can go to dansoder.com to find dates and get tickets and watch that 2019 HBO special, Son of Gary, I think was a big deal for him. And I think I had just seen it when I had this conversation with him.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
I mean, I know enough about myself to know I'm not, I'm too panicky, too worried, you know, and I'm just too selfish.
You know what mine is?
What?
I want to be liked too bad.
Well, yeah.
So I'd be like, I would do stupid things to get my kid to like me.
I you know, it's like I push back on the people liking me too much.
You're like, hey, you know what? Watch this.
Yeah.
You're like, you think you like me?
Yeah. Let's just keep a healthy distance. I think my entire comedy career was sort of navigating that, sort of wanting to be liked with, like, I don't trust you at all.
Oh, man, it's so crazy because as a people pleaser, one of the main things you realize is I don't want half these motherfuckers to like me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do I want you?
Well, people pleasing, that's a, like, I don't know. Maybe I fought that too, but I think I have more of it than I think. I'm a little older than you.
Yeah.
I come from a certain amount of chaos.
Yeah.
Not the same kind of chaos.
Sure.
But once you realize, you know, that you don't have the emotional autonomy that you think you do because you either have been trained by a parent to accommodate them.
My God.
Right?
My God. I was raised by a single mom, so mine was be a soldier.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was just be a good soldier.
Oh, really?
And so then I never
she didn't lean on you?
Yeah, but in weird ways of like keeping the house clean, of being a good soldier.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's the best way I can describe my childhood.
And you grew up in, where is it?
Aurora.
So, I grew up in New Mexico, so we're sort of like, there's a thing about Southwestern, and but it is
the Rocky Mountain High Plains.
The Rocky Mountain townie.
Yeah, it is. It's weird being from, one of the funniest conversations was, I was on the phone with Bobby Kelly, and he was with
Bobby,
and he was with Colin Quinn.
Colin
and Bobby. It was right when I started opening for Bobby, and Bobby goes, "Yeah, I'm on the phone with this kid, Dan Soda. He's from where? You from Soda?" I go, "I'm from Aurora, Colorado." And Colin's just a genius.
Yeah.
And Colin immediately goes, "Oh yeah, suburbs. Nice suburbs in the 70s, dilapidated from the 80s and 90s. I'm like, that's exactly what it is. It's just like moved on suburbs.
Like Quinn has like been making notes across America.
Yeah, he does. You can give him anything.
I feel like I remember Aurora. I don't know why I would have gone there, but I feel like I know it.
The mall shooting, that was big.
Oh, that was it.
That was Batman.
Oh, that was it.
Yeah, Colorado, we all have our own.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. We have our own shooting
stores. Columbine, too?
Columbine's more towards Littleton. West of Denver. But yeah, we were the Joker movie theater.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, Aurora Mall.
And then I thought about Arvada.
Yeah, Arvada,
because there's a record store I go to when I go to Denver in Arvada.
Okay.
So I drive up there.
Yeah.
It's called Red and Black something. It's Books and Records.
Denver's an interesting town. Because
it's all right. It's a little drunky. There's always the possibility someone's going to fucking pass out. Like, they're one of the first places to legalize the weed. So you do these shows.
Yeah.
You do these shows where you downtown Denver, it's like, what the fuck is happening? It's like Glasgow. There's just people running into walls.
People get fucked up since 2014. But you know what? Hmm. People don't realize this. People were getting that fucked up before 2014.
But the altitude, too.
It's a training ground. I'll tell you, as an alcoholic from Colorado, I was built. Yeah. I was built. Because I moved down to sea level when I was 18.
Yeah, oh, you cannot drink anybody?
Laying motherfuckers out. It was just a different world.
So wait, now you got engaged?
Yeah, I got engaged about a year ago.
It's weird. Like, my experience is, I think we've met a couple times, not
so
much.
I think you know what's funny?
Do we have a problem?
No, not at all.
You might not, but we'll work it out.
Yeah. So we've met at festivals.
Right.
A couple times through friends. Nate Bargatze introduced me to you a couple times.
Nate.
Just one of the best.
He is one of the best.
And what you don't remember was... In 2008, 2009, we would talk all the time at the bar at Eastville Comedy Club on 4th Street.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And right after you got let go of Air America,
right.
was right when I got fired at K-Rock.
Oh, wow.
So, and we used to sit at the bar and talk shit about radio, just almost like less than a handful of times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we sat there, and I was like I was like new to the city, still doing mics.
Oh, so was I old bitter guy?
No, but I just had the radio thing.
Yeah.
I had the radio way to talk to you.
Right.
That was the way in.
Right, so we could talk radio.
Yeah, and you got let go of Air America.
Yeah.
K-Rock had just flipped from rock to pop, so they let everybody go.
So you were a real jock?
I did overnights and weekends.
Really?
Yeah, and I had been doing that since I was 19 in Tucson.
In Tucson.
Yeah, I went to Tucson. I went to the U of A.
All right, let's back up. Let me just, like, before we go into the U of A, my brother went to the U of A.
Okay.
I know Tucson. But the last time I saw you, though, I was like, it's memorable to me because I'd come to New York. I don't do as many sets at clubs as I used to because—
Because you just get to this point where you really are, you're old enough that you're like, I don't do this anymore.
Well, I mean, I like the place I used to, but it's not the same place I came up in. A lot of the guys are gone. Some are dead. So I hadn't been doing spots in New York much. And I came in from L.A. and I went over there. And I mean, Esty said, you know, go over to the Underground and do a spot. And you went on before me and just leveled the place.
Oh.
And I didn't have my New York chops in order. So I just remember you killing them, me standing in the back of the room going, nah, fuck. And then I go up there. And it was one of those sets. And it doesn't happen often when you've been doing it as long as I have, where you just feel that sweat on the back of your neck. It's the worst because your body is not reading that. Like, I'm going down.
Yeah.
But that sweat on the back of your neck.
The flop sweat of just knowing.
Yeah, that's I'm not going to pull it off.
Or it'll be in the back of your jaw where you'll start feeling it.
Yeah.
Like the little clenching.
But and you trained yourself not to show it unless you're going to snap or you're going to acknowledge it. But, you know, I just couldn't. Yeah, it was a good feeling.
What I remember from
that. I didn't blame you for too long.
From that, what I remember from that interaction is.
You do remember that?
I remember. I don't remember me doing well. Yeah. I don't remember any of me doing positive.
Right, right.
What I remember is you coming downstairs.
Yeah.
And I was sitting talking to Liz, the manager.
Yeah.
And I had my hands kind of under my chin on the stairs. Mm. And I turned around and I went like, oh, hey, like, because I just had my hands, and I went, oh, and I thought I did such an L.A. thing at you, where the prayer hands, when really I just had my hands together, I was like, oh, hey, Mark, like, you were walking by, and I was like, Mark Maron thinks I'm a dildo, because I just did, like, the, hey, how are you?
Yeah. No, I just thought you were a dildo for killing so hard.
Well, I'll take that being a dildo any day.
And making it hard for me, because I personalize everything.
Yeah, but but back in 08, I remember, first off, I remember this story. You had an apartment in Astoria.
Yeah.
And I lived in Astoria for 17 years.
Yeah.
And
where?
Right on 31st Street and 28th Avenue.
So I lived at 37th and 30th Avenue.
I know that because Louis Katz.
Yeah.
One of my closest friends.
He just emailed me.
Yeah, I love him. We're great. Just in San Diego together.
Yeah.
This is 07, 08.
Okay, yeah.
And he texts me. Hey, I'm thinking about moving into Maron's apartment. Maron's moving to LA.
Yeah.
He's moving back to LA. I might take Maron's apartment. Why don't we meet up and get lunch?
Yeah.
I was like, absolutely, dude. I live in between the 30th Avenue stop and the Astoria Boulevard stop.
Right, yeah.
I'll walk over.
Yeah.
He gets off the train at 30th Avenue. And I remember this specifically. He goes, so where do you want to eat lunch? I go, there's a Subway down over there. And he goes, you fucking white trash, dude. You live in one of the greatest neighborhoods for food. And it took me a while to discover all the stuff.
Yeah.
But now, looking back, I'm like, I'm so embarrassed that I was like, Subway?
Yeah, there's
I recommended Subway when there's Taverna, there's like BZ Grill, there's like incredible food.
Yeah. Well, you grew up in Colorado. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I was like, well, there's a Burger King.
Yeah, yeah, let's do that.
Hiking distance. It's always Colorado terms.
So I
hike up to the Burger King.
Sure. So I'm watching. Well, how far up did you guys have like those regional chains like Blake's, Whataburger, or is that New Mexico? I don't think
Whataburger was New Mexico.
Whataburger was a little, there was around, but Blake's Whataburger was definitely New Mexico.
Okay.
But I don't know what's up in Colorado. I don't know what's spread out that far. Piggly Wiggly's?
No, we didn't get the Piggly Wiggly's. I think those stopped at New Mexico.
Circle K's.
Circle K's we had.
That's, yeah, they're around everywhere, I guess.
Yeah, I used to hang outside of Circle K.
Sure.
When I was 13, and asked guys to buy me cigarettes.
Yeah, buy cigarettes, of course.
With $3?
Yeah.
That's how much cigarettes
$3. When I was in high school, I remember them being at the Husky station. Like, I swear to God, they were 55 cents a pack. Is that possible?
My mom said
in 1980?
Yeah, my mom said she quit smoking cigarettes when they got to $1.50.
Right.
And that was 1988.
Right, so I was probably right. It was crazy. What'd you smoke?
I smoked Camel Lights.
And that's how you started?
I started with Marlboro Reds
because that's
what my dad smoked.
Marlboro Reds.
And then I moved to Marlboro Lights because I didn't want to tell my friends, but it was hurting.
Sure. It always hurts.
We were 13.
You quit, though?
I quit when I was 29.
So I started smoking when I was 14. So you were 13.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or 12. I was 12 when I started.
12.
It was seventh grade.
Well, right. I was watching your special, and it's funny to me that you're now engaged because, what was that? When did you record that? 2018?
2019,
2019, when did you get engaged?
2022.
See, like, I don't know, like, because here's what I couldn't get out of my head. It's like, because I've watched a lot of specials, and I watch a lot of the times the guys come on, but you're pretty straightforward. You're honest and, you know, uncomfortably honest in some places, and I'm familiar with that. I do that myself.
Yeah.
But I thought if you were to just edit that special, it would be an interesting dating profile because it would just be like, I'm Dan from Aurora, Colorado. I had a single mom. My hobbies are getting high and showering.
Yeah.
Getting high and eating.
Yeah.
Getting high and listening to music.
Yeah.
Getting high and talking to myself and laughing.
Yeah.
Getting high and talking to myself and laughing in the shower.
Yeah.
I aggressively and passionately will eat ass and pussy.
Yeah.
And I'm a really good fuck. And I want no emotional commitments.
Dude, it's almost crazy because you said if you were to do that like a time capsule.
Yes.
So much stuff has changed.
Well, I mean, that was like, I know, that's what I'm thinking.
With the craziest one.
Yeah.
The biggest reveal.
You stopped eating ass.
Well, I haven't ate ass in quite some time because I've been in a loving relationship.
Oh, that was just something you do to avoid intimacy? That's
just something where you're like, look at me eating your shit.
Yeah.
Look at me eating your shit. But I can't smell. And I never.
Anymore? Or
in the joke, I've always had a very low, like a very weak sense of smell.
Yeah.
And because of cigarettes,
yeah,
it's gone. And so when when COVID dropped and everyone was like, oh, one of the symptoms where you can't smell, I was like, I don't think I've been able to smell for a while.
Huh. And it goes in and out. You really think you killed your nose?
I mean, what's weird is
yeah.
My fiance Katie had nail polish remover.
Yeah.
She was like, look at that. Yeah. This is like 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I went, nothing.
Really?
And I went like that. And then I lifted my nose up like this.
Yeah.
And I got a whiff.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I caught a little bit of it.
Yeah.
And she's like, man, we got to get you to a doctor.
That can fix it.
Fix whatever the fuck's going on.
Well, did you get punched in the face?
Yeah, when I was little. So it might have been, you know.
So that's a broken nose?
I also hit it on a mailbox riding a bike one time.
Break it?
Yeah. My mom did the single mom thing where she was like, yeah, we don't have time to go to the hospital. So like let's just.
The boxing thing?
Yeah. She was like, we're just going to put it in the middle. And I remember being like, I'm sorry. Because when you get injured.
Yeah.
You know, with a single mom, she's
sure.
like, fuck, I got to leave work. I got to do something.
Well, like how much of that stuff, like, because I'm finding that at my age, because I talked sort of shamelessly about some of the same things you did in terms of the type of people you have sex with.
Sure.
You know, and like I've grown to realize that when you're that kind of person, you're just out there fucking.
Yeah.
That it's actually protecting you from intimacy.
Yeah, it's
and
it took the pandemic. It took living with someone. I've never lived with a woman.
Yeah, it sounded like you were pretty dead set on just.
And she cracked me. What's funny is that taping of that special was our second date.
Wow,
our second date. She was at that special, which was great when you're dating because you're like
watch me talk about all these other chicks I fucked.
Dude, it was. I was like, so some of that stuff, but she's so great. She understood it. And what was weird is living together in the pandemic and understanding that I felt like my comedy was, I liked the jokes, but I didn't think it was cracking through. And then I realized all stuff
cracking through yourself.
Yeah. Like really getting to
my
core.
Even
the mantle. And I realized, you know, I've been in therapy for 12 years.
Have you?
Yeah. But I realized, oh, I'm not letting anyone in.
Right.
And that includes not only my partners, but the audience. I'm not really.
You're putting on a show.
Yeah. I'm like,
the Irish charm offensive.
Yeah. That's exactly it. I'm letting you in part way.
Yeah.
It's like my Swedish side is stubborn. My Irish side is like, you can get, that's far enough.
Yeah.
That's far enough.
Yeah, you got enough.
You're in.
Yeah, you know, I showed you the sadness.
Yeah. So just know that there's sadness, okay?
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's what's behind that door.
Yeah.
But to actually let someone in has been very rewarding.
Yeah.
It's been very like,
well,
oh shit, all right.
Because I deal with this now, like on stage, like, you know, how much, but what do we, because you're a guy, that, like I do what you do. I talk about myself.
Sure.
And I talk about, you know, things that are emotionally disturbing, all the shit. You know, that's the world we're in. Long form, personal comedy.
I like that.
Observation. Well, that's what we do, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to evolve as you evolve, right? But then you start to wonder, and I don't know if you get this, I don't know how you write either, is this sort of, I talked about the other night, I did an alt show for the first time in forever. It was outside at a record store.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did some shit that I'm working on that's pretty serious, it's pretty heavy, But from talking about Lynn's death, you know, I know how to get in there and work that shit out. But, like, I said something. I said, this was a real alt set, man. Because back in the day, you do one of these sets and you go home and you go, like, why'd I tell those people
that? You go, I let a lot loose, man.
Yeah, man. I don't know those fucking people.
A lot of people got a lot of info on right now.
That's right.
I gave out a dossier.
Right.
Yeah.
An emotional dossier.
It is.
Do you feel that?
Yeah, you know, I've been doing this bit. I got hair surgery during the pandemic.
What does that mean?
I got the back of my head chopped off and put on the top of my head.
Were you bald up there?
I was going bald.
On the back or in the front?
On the front. And this doctor was like, oh, we cure that now.
Really?
This doctor was like, oh, this is easy. Literally the way he sold me. I'm such a mark,
yeah.
And you'll learn that about me.
Really?
I'm a true mark. I'm a huge professional wrestling fan. I can be bought in. You're lucky.
You don't strike me as a mark, but maybe I can.
You're lucky I wasn't climbing the walls of the Capitol on January 6th. That's how big of a mark I am.
But because you know it, as I do too, you have to be hypervigilant about what you let in.
Exactly.
Before you open your mouth and say, like, this kind of makes sense, you're like, hold on.
Yeah. But I got in that moment. This doctor's like, one surgery.
Yeah.
We could do it here and you won't ever go bald.
Right.
And it was like, I rushed to do it.
Yeah.
Because I'm also an addict.
Yeah, sure.
So you know that. Right. Like, that feeling of like, oh, make it all better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, this will make it all better? Make it all better.
Tomorrow.
Pour me a drink. That makes it better?
Yeah,
that makes it all better.
Yeah.
And so this guy did it, and I did it. I got the surgery, and then I regretted it.
Really?
I got it.
It looks good, though.
It's great.
How long ago was that?
I've been saying on stage about a year ago.
Oh, really? So until then, I don't even see where it happened.
It was coming in, but on stage, I call it my hair tits, that I got hair tits done.
Yeah.
But what happened was I got it done, and then I hit this moment of like, what did I do?
Right.
I should have just gone bald. Who the fuck am I? Should I just go bald? You.
Yeah.
And then it's this, you know, that mean part of your brain that's like, you pussy.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you suck it up?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then
you
I said,
vain girl.
And I, exactly. And I turned to Katie and I'm like, I think I regret this or whatever. And she goes, well, lucky for you, you can always write bits about it.
Right.
And you can go on stage and talk about it.
Right.
And somehow, in a way of opening up to that level of insecurity, that felt like intimacy, to be like, hey guys, I was really insecure about the size of my head and how I was going bald.
Yeah.
But you think, you know, talking about my dead
dad. You
got
head size problems?
Oh my God, I wear a size 8 fitted hat.
I wear an 8 3/4.
You're the first person I've ever met over an 8.
No, dude, and I'm shorter than you. It's ridiculous. I see pictures of me, I'm like,
battering ram.
I'm like a fucking bobblehead.
Yeah, that's how I felt my whole life.
The only thing I ever say to myself is, most movie stars are short with big heads.
Every big head guy tells himself that.
I know, but like, I watch myself on camera and I'm like, I still look like a guy with a big head.
Yeah,
it's not working.
Every big head guy goes, you know, that movie means stars. It's going to be a movie star.
What about your dad?
But when I was on stage, you know, the first step of that was talking about my dad dying.
Right.
Like you said, when you're talking about Lynn, there's a thing that we have a certain skill set where once you know how to do that, it's like a mechanic. You're like, I know how to fix that. I know how to do that.
Well, yeah, you're kind of making it better for yourself in a way.
Exactly.
But it was interesting the way you framed that, though, because you sort of defended him, and I can't imagine that's the reality of it.
No, not at all. Not at all.
You're like, fact, my dad left. He was a drunk. And then he said, he died partying.
Yeah.
You know, sort
because
like,
it
ugh.
Was it was an easier way of, it was a funny way of being like, oh, he abandoned me and didn't care.
Right. But in the end, you did the codependent thing and you're like, you're just having a great time.
Yeah. I really.
Out on the beach.
I forgave my parents for every misstep and never allowed myself to feel the anger. And actually process.
So is that really forgiving or is that just sort of shutting it down?
It's shutting it down.
So, okay, so you're growing up, your dad left when?
My parents broke up when I was 5. My dad.
And you had a relationship with the guy though?
Yeah, we were real close.
Oh, okay.
When I was under the age of 5, so my mom worked at Aetna. I was born in Hartford, Connecticut. And my mom.
Man. Lucky you got out of there.
I know, right?
There's nothing going on there.
Yeah, I know. I drive through there and I go,
what is happening?
At least my parents fucked here.
Yeah. I came from here.
Yeah, at least this is where they put this fucking soul in a little
egg
piece of meat.
Yeah.
But my parents moved. My mom got transferred from Aetna to Denver.
Okay.
And when she got transferred, that's when they broke up because she found out he had been stealing from their mutual account.
Uh-huh.
To pay off a guy. My dad
this is always a good story. To pay off a guy.
Yeah, my dad was a bartender in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Wall Street guys would come in.
Right.
This is the 80s.
So he's a mark too?
He was a mark.
Oh yeah, what happened?
This guy was like, oh yeah, you just take this money, you put it in the Wall Street, and then it comes back out.
Yeah.
My dad had zero business fucking with Wall Street.
Right.
So he took a loan from a guy.
Yeah.
For like 15K.
Yeah. What was the VIG?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he lost it.
Yeah.
And instead of telling my mom that he fucked up,
he
just took the money out of their mutual account. And this is before the internet.
Uh huh.
Just signed the check.
Was it one of the boys? who he took the loan from? Like, was it a mob thing?
I think it was, no. It was not a connected man. Mm. I think it was a guy that worked at a firm in New York that was a regular off the train.
Yeah.
Would come and get drunk.
Sure.
And my dad was very personable.
Yeah.
He was a great bartender.
Right.
And
That's why you're a comic.
Yeah. I used to watch my dad. So he stole. He didn't tell my mom. Mm. And then my mom moved to Colorado and kind of figured it out when the bank called and was like, hey, you've been past drawn and we're going to have to shut this down.
Yeah.
And then my mom had to file for bankruptcy and she kicked him out.
Oh, yeah. That was it.
And it was it. And then he moved back. He's from the Bay Area. So he moved to the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And, but we were real close up until then, like 1 to 5, since my mom worked during the day.
Yeah. He'd sit you up on the bar.
Oh, dude. Even better.
Yeah.
So when my parents broke up, he moved to San Francisco. And then when I was about 10, he moved with my grandmother to this place called Lake County, Northern California.
Yeah.
He would bartend at a bowling alley.
Oh, nice.
And I would just sit behind the bar on a milk crate.
Yeah.
Reading comic books.
At 11 or so, or 10?
I was like 9 and
10. Yeah, yeah.
8, 9, and 10.
Uh-huh. And you have siblings?
I had a sister whose birthday it is today.
Oh.
And she passed away when I was 16. Oh. She got killed in a car accident when I was 16. She was my half-sister.
In Aurora?
No, and she actually died in Los Angeles on Interstate 10. She was from Fontana and Riverside.
She's your half-sister? Yeah. How?
My dad had her when he was 20 in the Navy.
And you had, but you were close?
Yeah, my mom made sure of that. Because he abandoned that family. Then he abandoned our family.
Yeah.
So my mom reached out to his ex-wife and was like, hey, these kids should know each other since they got a common thing going on. And my sister was 12 years older. And she was great, man. She, you know, in a lot of ways, I think my sister saved my life by being the one person I could trust and one person that saw me for me. And
yeah. Like, when did you realize that?
When I was about, after she passed away, definitely, but when she was still alive, she would just kind of pull me aside and be like, these people are fucking nuts, dude.
Yeah.
Your mom and her boyfriend are nuts.
Yeah.
Fuck our dad's whole family.
Yeah.
Fuck that whole family.
Yeah.
She's like, but you're a good kid. And like, do what you love.
Yeah.
She got me into music. I used to listen to music and I would only listen to the hits. I remember that.
Sure, because you grew up in it.
Yeah.
So everywhere, the hits. Whatever year you grew up in, it's like those are the ones that are in there.
Yeah, and I remember I finally got into Jimi Hendrix.
Sure.
I was like—
Because of her?
11 or 12.
Sure.
And it was probably because of a movie All Along the Watchtower. And then I got the best of Jimi Hendrix or whatever.
Yeah.
And she was like— I was like, no, I love Jimmy. She's like, name a song that isn't Purple Haze or All Along the Watchtower. And I was like, hey, Joe.
Yeah.
And I was like, so proud of that.
Yeah.
She was like, no, dude, like, listen to the albums. And she was the first person that sat me down. She's like, if you like an artist, listen to their full album.
Sure.
And you'll find songs that no one else likes that mean more to you.
Yeah.
And that lesson changed the way that I take in stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, well, there's a whole product. I'm a massive Queens of the Stone Age fan.
Oh, yeah.
Favorite band.
Oh,
you had Josh Homme on. I know.
I did.
I listened to that interview on a bus to a gig in Boston, and it was one of my favorite interviews.
Oh, good.
Because you asked him a question specifically that I remember. You were talking about, you said, you don't sing lead on some of your songs. I think you were specifically speaking about Mark Lanegan from the Screaming Trees, who sang my favorite Queens of the Stone Age song, In the Fade, which is what closes out my HBO special.
Yeah, it's great.
But Josh Homme answered, he said, I want to make something great. I don't care how small of a part of it I am. And that to me, I was on a bus going to a gig, listening on my phone.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, that's the way to create.
Yeah.
The way to create is like
selfless collaboration,
but to remove the ego.
Right.
Is what you're making, is the goal to make something that you're proud of, that you've put yourself into, no matter how large of a role you have in it.
Yeah.
And I loved it. But my sister was the one that got me to listen to music in a way where I got into Soundgarden deeper than a lot of people.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I would just fall in love with certain songs.
Yeah.
And so that was always
those old Soundgarden, like the old Soundgarden, like Loud Love.
Oh my God.
Or what's that one, Gun?
I mean, my favorite song is from Super Unknown, one of their most famous albums.
Yeah.
But 4th of July, no one talks about.
No, yeah.
And it's a song that I come on. I played that for Louis on the drive up, and he was like, yeah, I don't really fuck with Soundgarden. He's like, but this song is unbelievable.
How can you not fuck with Soundgarden?
I know, they're unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in like a deep vinyl hole right now. I mean, I've got thousands of, I sat down last night and I just listened to like all all of the Velvet Underground loaded.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, yeah.
That kind of shit. And when she did that to me with music, that unlocked me doing that with comedy, which is what I've always been obsessed with, which was stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Like, so I started listening to like random ass albums.
Yeah.
And getting into like comedy scenes where I wasn't living anywhere.
Like near, what?
Like New York.
Yeah.
I got specifically Colin Quinn and kind of all the branches of that tree.
The branches of the tough crowd, like the Geraldo, Patrice.
Yes. Bill Burr. It was all those guys, Bobby Kelly, Keith Robinson, all these
guys.
How's
Bobby doing?
He's doing great. Good. I love him, dude.
I love him too.
He's like an older brother to me.
Yeah, I just he's an honest fucker.
Dude, he'll call me and he'll be like, dude, and you just know you're getting a real conversation with Bobby. But that kind of love for stand up, I think, is what got me into, especially like, I got into all these old specials. I was just watching shit from the 90s.
Yeah.
All the young comics of comedy.
It's wild, right? It's interesting how that stuff, a lot of it doesn't hold up.
Yeah.
But you can see who the guys were when
they're
kids.
There's one from 1994 or 5, Young Comedians of Comedy, taped at Aspen.
Yeah. Oh, got it.
And it's Chappelle.
I know, yeah. And then the guy.
Louie.
Yeah.
And Attell.
Yeah. And then what's his name? The Canadian with the cigar who tanked.
Fucking, yes.
I think he's dead.
Oh, well, he was the other guy.
Yeah. I was there. I was there that year. And I watched that show. What the fuck was his name?
I don't know.
He went up there with such confidence.
Because the other guys didn't. Louie, Attell, and
killed.
Chappelle.
Yeah, they
but
killed.
They weren't.
No, they were young.
Young, and that's what's funny is you see when you watch those sets.
Oh, see, it's sad. I can't remember that guy's name, that poor guy.
The glimmer of, you see like, oh, that's going to be Attell. Attell does like a move.
Well, Attell by that time was pretty Attell.
But he wasn't Attelling.
Yeah.
He wasn't double hands on the mic.
Well, he wasn't
pointing.
Broken totally.
but he hit like his pace.
Yeah.
And then there was a moment where Louis does a joke that's a very... like Louis from 08 joke.
So it was more absurdism than biographical.
And Chappelle was doing like, he didn't have the same delivery.
Well, he was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, did he do the hat thing? Like it was much different.
I think he did the Batman joke. Where Batman never comes to a black neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah,
and you're
oh,
that's fun. You like see kind of how he works.
Everything's a little lighter.
Yes. And you saw that. And then like, you know, I grew up in a great time where Comedy Central cared about stand-up.
Yeah.
So they were putting on, come home from school, watch Premium Blend.
Yeah.
Or they'd run old A-lists from Bravo.
Talked to Richard Lewis about my A-list.
Yeah, that was the
yesterday.
One that was, you know, one of my favorite pictures of my dad.
Yeah.
He's on vacation. It's just like a very nice, pleasant picture of him.
Yeah.
Because it got real dark.
Yeah.
But he is, he's sitting there with his legs crossed and he's got an MTV Half Hour Comedy Hour shirt on.
Yeah.
And I was like, I remember watching those.
I remember doing those.
I mean, that's what I mean. It's crazy. It's
well, that was a whole different time because I came up in that time and there was just this huge basic cable explosion.
Yeah.
Where they just needed people.
Yeah.
I mean, people can do their own thing now and it seems like anybody can get on the thing.
Sure.
But back then, to get on TV, it meant something. There was no internet. There was no YouTube. So you were always taping these fucking things, and every one of those basic cable networks had a thing at least once a year.
Yeah.
A new comedy showcase. It was kind of crazy.
And I loved it. You're just like, I would turn it on and I'd be like, okay, they're doing comedy outside at the beach in Miami.
Yeah.
I'll watch this.
Try to avoid that one. That was John Stewart hosted that, right?
Yeah. I think it was. I think it was John Stewart.
Yeah.
And it was like
Spring Break.
But it was my, like, I'm sure the way musicians get into music and then start getting
more
hyper focused on certain stuff.
Uh huh.
That was.
Because when I was coming up, you had to go to the specials that were available from HBO.
Yeah.
There wasn't, you know, or my peers, you know, I came up with that generation, you know, me, Todd Barry, Attell, CK, Nick DiPaolo,
Patton Oswalt.
No, he was later.
Really?
Yeah, I was with the New York crew.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like, it was Jeff Ross, Silverman, Rogel. I mean, these guys.
Kevin Brennan.
Yes.
Yeah.
When he was before he broke.
Yeah, well, I remember even like being at the Cellar one time, Sarah Silverman sat down and she was like, where do you live? And I was like, Astoria. And she immediately went, oh, I lost my virginity to Kevin Brennan in Astoria. And you're like, it was such a Sarah Silverman moment
sure.
that I was sitting there like, this is surreal.
Yeah.
And as a comedy fan.
You should have asked her about the who followed Kevin.
Because yeah.
I think there's a fairly long line of comics, not including me.
Yeah.
I was odd man out on that one. But Kevin and I, yeah, we started together. He was intense. He's always been intense.
Always
very funny. Yeah.
Very funny. Yeah. And then like, that was the group. Your guys' group in New York.
Yeah.
That solidified, like, oh, I want to go there.
Yeah, that was the first real, you know, crew that were sort of identifiable because of those shows you were talking
about.
Yeah,
and they would talk shit to each other.
Yeah.
Whenever I would hear them on stuff, they would bust balls the way as me and my friends did. So I was like, I kind of liked this.
Yeah.
And I liked it. Everything about the New York comedy scene. What I could see in Insomniac, what I could see in Tough Crowd, what I could see on the comedian documentary that Seinfeld did.
Oh, man.
With Orny Adams. That documentary was like, oh, man, it was my favorite thing to watch when I would get home.
Yeah.
If I was bored, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to put on Comedian.
Yeah.
I liked how they put all the different music that was in it. But specifically what I loved was Colin Quinn.
Sure, Colin.
He was the guy that I gravitated to in that whole documentary.
Well, you guys are similar. You're just like smart Irish guys.
Yeah, but it was charming
smart Irish guys that talk a lot.
Yeah, just motor mouth.
Yeah.
But it was fun watching that and then being like through that being like, okay, I think I want to go east because I started in Tucson.
Yeah. Well, that's right. So so your dad is full on drunk?
Yeah.
And that's what killed him?
Yeah. He got hepatitis C.
Oh, fuck.
From fucking around in this lake town.
Yeah.
And then he drank so hard and didn't go to the doctor.
Oh, they can cure that now. It's too bad.
Dude.
Yeah.
I told Louis this story.
Louis Katz or CK?
Louis Katz.
Yeah.
We were driving and I told him the story about my grandmother.
Yeah.
And he was like, how are you not doing that as a bit? And I was like, it's too dark.
Which one?
So my dad got hepatitis C, which turned into cirrhosis, and then he died.
You were in high school?
Yeah, I was 14.
Yeah.
I was a freshman in high school.
Where did he die?
He died in the VA in San Francisco.
Okay.
But he...
What was he a VA of?
Vietnam.
Did he...
Vietnam.
Was he there?
No, he was in the Navy. Okay. He cooked in the Navy.
Okay.
He got drunk on the roof.
On the boat?
While they fired missiles at the fucking...
Okay.
At the Da Nang River.
Yeah.
He like didn't even...
Didn't
he
was get like, off the
yeah,
boat?
I did Vietnam. He's like, I fought in Vietnam, but he'd always do the hand jerk.
You know, sure,
like,
sure.
I fought in Vietnam.
Yeah. Where was he from? San Francisco?
Oakland. Yeah.
Okay.
He grew up in Oakland.
All right, so your grandma?
So... my dad gets hepatitis C. It turns to cirrhosis. My aunt, Karen, was a registered nurse.
Yeah.
So she's like, I'm going to come help my brother.
Yeah.
She's taking care of him. He's throwing up blood.
Yeah.
And it gets into her eyes.
Yeah.
She didn't realize it. Some of it splashed. And she got hepatitis C.
Oh, my God.
And it turned into liver cancer.
Come on.
And she died.
What the fuck?
10 years later after my dad
That's
died.
An interesting, it's a family disease.
It is. It's what the Soders do.
But how do you get it that way?
Yeah.
She died of your fucking dad's alcoholism.
Or
bad behavior, whatever.
She basically was in the blast radius.
Yeah, I shouldn't judge the behavior, but whatever. He
was fun as hell. But But the joke I was telling Louie that it never worked was I play cards with my grandmother every time I visit her, and she's 96 now. But about fucking 3 years ago, we're playing gin rummy in the room, and the TV's in the other room, and the volume's on 100.
Yeah.
Because she's old.
Yeah.
And the commercial's like, hepatitis C is curable.
Yeah.
Go get your hepatitis C cure. And I'm like, I'm going to go turn down the TV. Both of her kids got taken out by this thing that they're like, not even a threat anymore.
Yeah.
And my grandmother's like, huh? And you're like, don't worry about it, Nana.
Yeah.
No, Hep C's still very dangerous.
Yeah.
Very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
But Louis's like, you got to talk about that on stage. I'm like, it's just so dark. I don't know how to get to it.
You just got to get a strong tag. You'll figure it out.
Yeah. But her being like, huh? And you're like, no, they said it's still not
terrible. Terrible.
Yeah.
Is she the Irish one?
No, my mom's side's the Irish one.
Oh, okay.
Surprisingly, the Swedish side are the ones that all died from drinking.
I think they're pretty big drinkers.
Yeah, they're low-key.
Yeah, yeah.
No one really.
Quiet drinkers.
You know, Giannis Pappas was telling me that, and I looked it up, the government controls their liquor stores.
Oh, really?
The government's
it's like in New Hampshire, an entire country of New Hampshire?
Yeah, they're like, shut it down. You guys have had too much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because when they do, they're just like...
They keep going.
Let's just keep going.
It's not even a taxing, or it's just a control thing.
Yeah, they're like, you guys go until you're dead.
They need people to be more alert at work in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was fascinated by that. I was like, the Irish side's all alive.
So when you're a kid, though, like, you're 14, he dies. So and you're leaning on professional wrestling?
Wrestling and comedy.
Yeah.
And football in the San Francisco 49ers.
Wrestling, because my, you know, my producer, you know, they do a weekly wrestling show on the bonus material.
Oh, I love it.
He tried to get me into it, and I had Chris Jericho on it. I had all the AEW guys.
AEW rules.
But you got to grow up with it, because I can't backload it.
Yes.
And I'm a 59-year-old Jew who likes music and whatnot. I'm not going to be like, I got to get to the wrestling match.
I'm going to tell you right now, the way you're built, you'll never be able to take in wrestling.
Really?
You know how they say learn a language first 5 years?
Right, yeah, exactly.
You can't learn another language.
That's right,
You can't learn wrestling.
But, we went and I talked to the guys because Brendan's so important to me.
And you were in GLOW?
He's a bright guy. Yeah, I was around it, but thank God that character didn't give a shit about wrestling.
Yeah.
But, I get it now. I won't be condescending about the nature of it.
I've learned, 40 years old, from 40 years of loving wrestling, I've learned how that, I don't resent people that mock it. I don't resent people that are like, it's not real. Or they're like, you're like, I love my fake gay fighting.
Yeah.
Let me have it.
Sure.
I love the thought of a dead man fighting the son of a plumber, for a piece of metal, for a hunk of metal to wear around their waist. Yeah. I love this shit because it turns my brain off.
Yeah.
And I also know the you know what it is? The outcome is determined.
Yeah.
So I know no matter what, it's been settled.
Right.
It's like this
not open-ended.
It's like this Buddhist thought where you're like, it has already been written.
Yes.
One hand writes the other. It is.
But if you spend your whole life in it, you know the different scripts, you know the guys that turn, you know the heel turn, you know all that stuff.
Love it.
But oddly though, culturally, it's very informative. In professional wrestling, if you spend your life watching it and loving it, you can really understand politics at this point in time. It's the entire right wing is a fucking bunch of heels.
It's the joke that I said in the HBO special where I said, Donald Trump, Ric Flair'd his way into the White House.
He's one of the greatest heels that ever lived.
He was great when he participated with the WWE.
Yeah.
And honestly,
unfortunately, the world hangs in the balance.
I know.
One of the great heel turns.
Dude,
but he was always a heel. There was no turn.
Katie and I were talking about, for some reason, we were talking about wrestling and politics and all that mixture or whatever. And she goes, oh, yeah, politics is wrestling, but it's wrestling where the fans get really hurt by what the wrestlers do.
Sure.
And I was like, I've never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
I was like, that's fucking insane. And it's true.
Yeah.
And,
And they don't know that they are because they believe it.
Yeah. And Obama was kind of like a Hulk Hogan heel where everyone was, baby face.
Yeah.
Where everyone was like, we got a baby face. And he says all the right things.
Yeah.
And, and that's why everyone got stoked. And then you had kind of like a Stone Cold feel for the right when Donald Trump showed up, where they're like, he doesn't like the regular career politicians.
Yeah, yeah.
He's saying what he wants.
Yeah.
He's attacking.
Yeah.
They really like.
But unfortunately, the fans don't know it's fake.
I know. I know.
That's the difference between wrestling and politics.
That's why whenever I have a friend that's super into politics, I go, we're the same side. We're different sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
You believe in politics the way I believe in wrestling.
Right.
I'm lucky that I'm politically, I'm apolitical because I'm like, it's the left and right arm of the same monster.
Mm.
It's all going to the same rich people.
But you're a decent guy. I mean, really, it comes down to tolerance and thinking that everybody should be okay.
Yes. That's my philosophy of like,
sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Why don't we help out each other a little
bit? Yeah, right.
Seems a little.
So you how do you get to Tucson? You go to school there?
Yeah. So I graduated high school in Aurora, shout out Smoky Hill High School. And I.
When your dad died, though, did it shatter your life?
It made me mad. It made me real mad in a way of like, fuck, man, I thought we were going to repair that.
Yeah.
Because 1 to 5 was so good. And then 5 to 14.
But are you an alcoholic?
Yeah. Oh, and yeah.
Are you
started getting fucked up. 14, 15.
Are you sober?
I haven't drank in 10 years. I smoke weed still.
Yeah, yeah.
But not, honestly, my weed intake since 38.
Yeah.
What am I doing? I'm forgetting so much stuff and I'm
apparently
scared.
You're enjoying your day. You're forgetting stuff and you're scared. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, ugh.
And how about the self-consciousness
thing? Oh, my
God. Didn't you get like hyper, like a guy like you? I mean, like when I'd smoke weed during the day, any interaction was like, they're looking right through me. I can't.
I would do, I did 8 years of a radio show with Big J and we'd get high and I'd be like, what the fuck did I? I'd go home and I'd be like, what did I say?
Yeah,
what the fuck did I say? But my dad dies at 14 and I'm kind of like, I'm angry. My mom, the guy that's living with us, my mom's boyfriend was my godfather. He was a real shithead.
Oh, really?
He was my dad's ex-best friend. And
oh,
they were,
really?
Yeah, they were very okay with, you know, my mom since apologized. And yeah. My mom and I have had some real heart-to-hearts that have made our relationship much, much better than it was.
Yeah.
But when I was 14, I kind of just fucking hated everybody.
Yeah.
I was like, well, if my dad, except my sister.
Yeah. Were you fighting?
I wouldn't get in fights as much as I would just kind of like shut down and go be on my own, go upstairs or start getting fucked up. I really liked getting fucked up.
Well, it's weird about growing up in a small kind of southwestern town where, you know, because I don't know, we got our driver's licenses at 15 in New Mexico. How old were you?
16. We were 16, but.
But we would just go down to the shopping mall late at night and put shopping carts in front of the car and get them going like 40, 50 miles an hour and just let them run into shit.
Fun as hell.
That's what you do, man.
Yeah, and then I started getting into smoking weed at 14, 15.
No sports?
I played football, so I'd clean up, but I wasn't good.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a thing I needed that fatherly, like, attaboy.
Yeah.
I didn't have.
See, that's the fucking thing, right? That's part of the comic thing, too, is like you're looking for this approval. Like, my dad was just a bipolar, narcissistic fuck.
Yeah.
And, like, I get along fine with him now because he has dementia. He's very sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it's fucking flipped.
But it's weird that when there's an emotional absence there, you know, the sort of need for approval is fucked up.
It's, dude, I had a.
Anybody with a strong personality, you're like, I'm going to be part of you.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, how do you say that? You're like, it's like one of those movies where you're mimicking how their mouths say it. Right, where you're like when an alien comes to Earth and learns how to talk, and they go, you are saying, that's what it was like. And I was having my mom, you know, and no disrespect to her, but she was having a social life while I was spinning.
Yeah.
I didn't know who the fuck I was, and I'm having these different dudes come in. And I didn't want, I was on a podcast one time and someone was like, did you ever try to fuck with them or like scare them away?
Yeah.
And I was like, hell no.
Yeah.
I wanted a male role model so bad.
Right, right.
They were coming in. I was like, hello, sir.
Yeah.
I look forward to you being my father one day. Yeah.
And then you're wearing the same hat as them. And
yeah. And I'm like, well, I'm chewing tobacco because they chew tobacco. But it became a thing of when I was 14, I was like, well, I like getting fucked up. And it turns out I'm real good at it.
Yeah.
I could hold my shit.
Yeah.
And I could get fucked up and I wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
It was actually like silly.
So it made you, it took away the anger?
Took away the anger, took away everything, and then it became like, oh, I'm going to smoke weed all the time.
Yeah.
And I had a problem with like, oh, I don't want to drink because that's what my dad did.
Yeah.
But then I started drinking at 15 and I was like, oh, I can drink.
Hell yeah.
Like, oh, I forgot.
I just decided I want to be like my dad.
Oh my God, it's like finding out it was always this thing. When you have a dad that leaves, in your mind, somewhere in your mind, you go one of two things. He's either got another family, which that really hurts.
Yeah.
Getting cucked.
Yeah.
Just being like, oh, you're raising another boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Not me.
Who's that kid?
So you're worried about that.
Yeah.
Or the positive one is you're like, what if my dad's an assassin? What if my dad is gone because he has to go do all this? Like,
right, sure.
So in your head, you're like, well, he's going to come back and be like, you know how to... You were born to a long family of assassins. You're looking for a cool thing.
Sure.
No, just an alcoholic.
Yeah, right.
So you start drinking and you
not
go
so heroic.
Yeah. And then you start drinking and you go, oh, this is what we do. This is what our family does.
This is our superpower.
I'm very good at this. So I just, in high school, became the guy that was funny, got fucked up, didn't really bother anybody because that's kind of just what I wanted.
Yeah.
In high school, I was just kind of like, hey, come over to my house. When my sister died when I was 16.
Did that level you?
That destroyed me. That destroyed me. That made me, in a weird way, kind of shut down for a little bit. But then it made me realize, it made me believe in God, which is weird because you think it wouldn't.
Yeah.
You think it would do the opposite.
Wait, how did that manifest?
Well, when my dad died, I stopped believing in God. When my dad died, I was like, oh, well, what the fuck, dude?
Yeah.
Like, we were supposed to have the movie moment where he realizes, I shouldn't drink.
Yeah.
I got a good kid.
Yeah.
And then he comes back and I'm like, I'm mad at you, but I love you. And then we're okay.
Yeah.
And then roll credits.
Yeah.
But he died. And I was like, well, there goes that.
Yeah.
And then my sister, she would visit. She'd come and visit.
Yeah.
You know, she was a grown up.
Right.
She was 26 at this point when I was Or I was, when I was 14, she was 26.
Yeah.
And she helped me get through the death, through the funeral.
Yeah.
And then she visited to go to a Lilith Fair. And we were hanging out.
Yeah.
We were hanging out in the guest room. She was packing before she left.
Yeah.
And I was like, do you remember a couple of years ago? I was like, I don't think Dad's going to make it to my high school graduation. She was like, yeah, I remember you saying that.
Yeah.
She was like, that's so crazy you said that. And then he died 2 years later. She's like, but I'm going to make it. I'm going to be there at your high school graduation. And I was like, oh, I appreciate that. And like, we were just talking and, you know, and then she gave me this long speech about people die. It's a part of life. People come into your life and they affect it. And then they're gone. She's like, I've lost friends. I lost Dad. You know, she's like, I've lost a lot of people. She's like, but that doesn't take away from the love that you felt from them when they were here. That doesn't, one doesn't affect the other. Just because they die doesn't mean that they weren't here loving you. And that wasn't a real love. So we had this like very long conversation.
Huh.
And then I had to go to school the next day and I had football practice after. And so I get home from football practice and my sister's gone. My mom had taken her to the airport. And there was this letter on my bed that was like, hey, fuck all the bullshit about what Dad did to you and like what that family does to you. You're a good kid.
Yeah.
And you're turning out to be a good man.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of you.
Oh.
And you're very funny. And you're very like, you have a big heart. And she was like, don't stop doing that. And there was just this moment where I was like, man, that really meant a lot to me. And then 3 weeks later, she was killed in a car accident. And it just, there was this moment of like, oh, I got that. I got that like goodbye.
Yeah.
I got that like,
right.
That real like, hey, I love you.
Yeah.
You're going to be okay. I'll see you later. And it was like, I don't believe in religion because I think it's all business. But I believe in a creator to give me that moment. Because if I didn't have that moment, I'd be dead. I'd be fucking dead. I would have been so angry. I would have been so mad. I would have burned myself up.
Yeah. So in a sense that, the kind of talk you had and then the letter,
yeah,
there was like real closure somehow.
Yeah, I got closure. It was like handing a receipt before you buy something.
Right.
You're like, what's this receipt? You're like, I don't need that. And then you're like, oh, fuck.
So you're actually able to kind of grieve in a real way and have
closure, which was the problem I had with my father's death. Was I didn't get closure. Right. I didn't get to be like, dude, what the fuck, dude?
Yeah, yeah.
I loved you. Yeah. Where were you?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was so mad about that. And then with Michelle's death, it just was like, all right, like, fuck, it hurts.
Yeah.
I'm a walk off this pain.
Yeah.
But I had something that I could point to and be like, I got to say goodbye.
Yeah.
She said goodbye to me.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't really me saying goodbye to her, she got to say like, I love you.
Yeah.
I got you.
Yeah.
This love that I gave you, it's good.
And it stays.
It stays.
Yeah.
It doesn't go anywhere. And it that kind of, that pain motivated me.
Yeah.
Because I was like, well, if my sister's going to die, if my dad's going to die, and then my Aunt Karen, who I was close to, dies, if all these people around me are dying, why am I here? Well, it must be for a reason.
Yeah.
So I might as well make this life what I want it to be.
Right.
What do I love? I love music. I love comedy. So go fucking do all that shit.
Yeah.
And I moved to Tucson. I went to U of A. I got in there because my mom asked me one thing. She said, listen, I know you're not... Once Michelle died, my mom was like, what am I going to fucking tell you? You're a man. God is, you know, whatever you want to say, the world has calloused you. So I was smoking cigarettes. I could smoke weed in the garage, not in the house. Could not drive if I smoked weed. But my mom had a very, like, we became roommates.
Right.
Where she was like, hey, I got you. You got me.
Yeah.
But there was a respect. It just changed. My mom's energy towards me completely changed of like.
She understood the loss you went through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was like, and she respected me for it.
Right.
There was this weird like, all right, you're still, I didn't go crazy.
Yeah.
I was still respectful to her and stuff. But she was like, I respect what you've been through. And she asked me, she said, listen, just get a college degree.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
And also she didn't want you to get hard.
Yeah.
Or fuck your whole life up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why she was like, go to college.
Yeah.
You'll have experiences. Because I kind of already knew I wanted to do stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, go, just please for me, a single mom, get that college degree. Because in her generation, the boomer generation,
right,
that was like, oh, you did a good job.
Sure.
Your kids have college degrees.
Right.
You did it.
Yeah.
So I went to U of A. Yeah. I didn't want to go in Colorado. Yeah. I wanted to go to a place where I was a little uncomfortable.
Sure.
And I was like, Arizona, it's warm.
It's a good city, though.
Tucson, really knew nothing about it. Hated it.
Oh, really?
Hated it.
Why? Too dry? Too desert?
Too frat and sorority.
Party
too,
school.
Too rich kid.
Yeah.
I moved there, and it was like, I had like enough for cigarettes.
Yeah.
And then that was it.
Yeah.
And shit weed.
Yeah.
And like an 18-pack of Ice House.
Right.
And I would just like drink whatever I could.
Yeah.
I'd get whatever I could, and I didn't like it. And I was like talking to my mom, and I was like, I think I'm going to transfer back to Colorado.
Yeah.
Colorado State, or maybe. And my mom was like, huh, it doesn't seem like you'd have quit something like this.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, huh. You know, and then you're like, hey, you want to fucking challenge me?
Yeah.
And I went, and I was working at the college radio station, KAMP.
Yeah.
And I had like, and I kind of found like, you know, that first glimmer when you start doing stand up or you start doing something where you go like, oh, I like this.
Yeah, I can do this.
And
yeah.
I could maybe do this.
Yeah.
And I had a show at KAMP, Arizona Student Radio.
Yeah.
My boss was this guy, Vic Garcia.
Yeah.
Who ended up becoming my brother. He's my lifelong friend.
Yeah.
And he would let me fuck around.
Yeah.
I could fuck around. I could be funny. It was a news show.
Right.
But it was a comedy show.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, I like this. Well, I'll go work at the radio station. In between my freshman and sophomore year, I went and worked in Alaska. Because my dad's sister was up there.
Where?
My Aunt Karen.
Fairbanks?
In Kenai.
Uh-huh.
Which is in the Cook Inlet.
Yeah.
And my Aunt Karen had the cancer from the hepatitis C.
Yeah.
And she was up in Soldotna. She worked at a hospital in Soldotna.
Yeah.
And she was like, why don't you move up here?
Yeah.
She's like, what are you going to do in between your freshman and sophomore year of college? When you go work at Applebee's in Aurora?
Yeah.
She's like, come up here.
Yeah.
And I moved up there.
Huh.
Just kind of like sight unseen. Just like, yeah, fuck it. Alaska. Took two bags up there. And she's like, you got to get a job. I applied everywhere.
Yeah.
Restaurants, the radio station. And finally I went to the docks and I was like, you guys hiring? And they're like, we're always hiring. Yeah. And then I worked as a member of the dock crew at Pacific Star Seafood.
That's a classic Irish.
Yeah, it is like
old school.
I'll go find myself in the work.
Yeah.
And my mom is Irish Catholic. You know, she was the Irish family member. So I think I really got all like a lot of the personality traits of like, yeah, you fucking go work.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not work until you hurt.
Right.
And I went up there and, you know, I spent the first 2 weeks with my aunt and then I got hired and then I lived on the docks for 3 months.
Huh.
Made good money.
Just taking shit off boats?
Taking shit, fueling the boats, doing fish nights. A lot of the times
What's
I was-
What's a fish night?
Like, well, they only really fish for salmon Mondays and Wednesdays.
Okay.
This is 20 years ago. But Mondays and Wednesdays were fish nights and Fish and Game would come and like monitor to make sure you weren't overfishing the river.
Yeah.
The Kenai River is, you know, one of the largest salmon populations in the world. And they would monitor it. So dock crew, you're working on fish nights, you're working like 8 a.m. to 2 a.m.
Huh.
You're just going straight through. You get a lunch break, a dinner break, and then like another snack break.
Yeah.
But it was the shit. The guys I worked with, you know, Mike and Dave and like my roommate Steve and we would all just get really stoned at lunch.
Yeah.
And then fucking work.
Yeah.
And I like, and I was making them laugh. I was like getting them.
Yeah.
When we were getting high, I was like making them laugh like my buddies back in Aurora.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe I should do stand-up.
Yeah.
And my Aunt Karen and I, after, you know, when I would get nights where I could go to her house and have dinner. And I remember we were smoking cigarettes watching Daniel Tosh do stand-up. And I was like, he's so funny. I was like, do you think I could do stand-up? And she didn't even blink. She was like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was like in a weird way, just like her not even blinking and being like, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, well, I'm going to try this shit.
Yeah.
And so I moved back to Tucson for my sophomore year. Blew through the money, dude.
Good time?
I mean, was just like, I got it. Yeah. I was buying cartons of cigarettes.
Yeah.
I was loving life.
That's how we blow through money. I bought a whole carton.
Oh, dude, just in the freezer.
Yeah.
Just pull a new pack out in the freezer.
Yeah.
And I ran out of money after the fall semester. Spring semester, I'm like, well, fuck, I need a job. And I was like, well, maybe I'll work at the radio station. I loved working at KAMP. So let me go try to work at the alternative station, KFMA.
Yeah.
And I went there and bothered them.
Yeah.
And then I finally got the call and they're like, hey, we need you to work midnight to 6 a.m. on Friday and Saturday nights. And I was like, done. And through KFMA, I met much like more lifelong friends. Greg Shishman, who now lives in Seattle, from Albuquerque.
Yeah.
He says, what's up? He said, tell an Albuquerque kid in Albuquerque.
Nice.
But he works at the N now up in Seattle, and he was like my first professional big brother.
Yeah.
He was the first guy that I came into the radio station, and he's like, I'm going to teach you how to run the board.
Yeah.
I'm going to teach you how to do edits. I'm going to teach you how to do everything.
Yeah.
And I kind of was like, I found that first attaboy. Found that first, like, oh,
yeah, mentor.
Yeah, like I'm comfortable here.
Yeah.
I can learn, I can fail, but no one's going to be mad at me.
It's the middle of the night.
Middle of the night. Middle of the night. And I worked at KFMA. You know, the first shift I did, I'd never talked on the real radio.
Yeah.
And I was so fucking nervous.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, hey, it's just like you're talking to your friend. And I'm like, yeah. And I think the first break, I cracked the mic. I said, 92.1 and 101.3, my voice snapped. I was like, shit. And on our air check tape on the cassette, I wrote Scared Dan. And then on the other side, I wrote Not So Scared Dan, because it was the next shift and I was better.
Yeah.
And I took it into our music director at the time, Matt Spry, and he was like, Scared Dan.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I was scared. He goes, well, that's your radio name. And so for 4 years, I was Scared Dan on KFMA. And it was like, it gave me this ability to kind of like, it gave me momentum. And then I started doing the mics, and I did an open mic at Laughs in Tucson, and it went well. And then the next 4 months, bombed every mic.
Was Bynum there?
No, this was
post Bynum.
This was Scotty Goff, who bought it from Bynum and then sold it back to him. So this was the Scotty Goff era.
Because the first Laughs was in Albuquerque.
Oh, I know. That was my first road gig.
Yep,
it was working for. I was emceeing for a dirty magician.
Oh yeah, which one?
His name was. What was his
name? That's so funny. I broke in doing road work with a dirty magician.
Oh, my God.
No, hypnotist. I was with Frank Santos.
I know Frank Santos because of laughs. Frank Santos would come around. It was, his name was something, Chad Gross, I think.
Yeah.
But he was like, you know, he'd do the thing where the woman would put her hands through his thing, and he'd be like, now grab my belt. And you're like, you fucking perv.
Yeah.
But it was the first condo I stayed in, Albuquerque, driving from Tucson to Laughs.
Yeah.
I mean, from Tucson to Albuquerque. And, so I started going to Laughs, but I started bombing, and I couldn't. I was like, no, but my first set went so well.
Right.
What the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
And there was a KFMA staff dinner.
Yeah.
In the morning show, the Frank show, there was a comedian named Dave Ashley, who has since passed away.
He was a sidekick?
Yeah. He was like the comedian on the show, and he did stand-up at Laughs.
Right.
And him and his wife, Beth, were the nicest.
Yeah.
To, especially young comics.
Yeah.
You know that when you're coming up, you're like, I just want someone to be nice to me.
Yeah, yeah,
everyone's being fucking mean.
Yeah.
Someone be nice to me. And they, and Dave, we were at this
snap. Well, he sounds like a guy who found his groove.
Yeah.
Like he had the gig.
He was super funny, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember we were at this dinner because we had done well in the ratings.
Yeah.
So like the company took us out and I was the overnight guy. So I was just a free meal.
Yeah.
And we're at dinner and I'm telling Dave Ashley, I'm like, dude, I'm fucking bombing when I do these mics. And he goes, are you prepared? And I was like, even him saying that in the moment, I went, no. And he goes, he's riffing? I go, yeah, I'm just up there riffing. He goes, no, dude. He goes, I know you know stand-up. I go, yeah, I know people get jokes, but I thought they just riff and keep it. And he goes, no, write jokes.
Yeah.
He was the first person. It's so funny to say that now that I've been doing stand-up for 19 years or whatever, but it was like the first like, okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so I started, because of Dave Ashley, I started writing down like, oh, I think this is funny.
Yeah.
And then like learning how.
Sure.
And it changed.
Sure.
Mike started going well.
Give you more control.
Yeah.
It's funny about radio comics, they don't get credit, but those guys who went to radio in the 80s, you know, morning show comic radio is not easy.
No.
And it's like, you got to be, you know, firing on all cylinders. You got to be
4 a.m.
quick as shit. I always like have a real big place in my heart for morning crews, you know?
Yeah. And it was a thing where the Frank show was so popular and like they were like the rock stars of our station.
Yeah.
That it was kind of cool even to be affiliated with them.
Yeah.
It was kind of cool to be like, first time I went on the Frank show, I was just trying to be funny.
Yeah.
And I remember Frank was like, man, you're green.
He's like,
you are just launching
jokes. Take it down a notch. Yeah.
It was the same as when I fucked an older woman for the first time.
Yeah.
Slow down. I was like, slow the fuck down. Yeah. Because I was just like,
focus.
I was just like, I'm going to give it to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, KFMA kind of became my safe house in Tucson. It became the place that I could go where I wasn't at U of A.
Yeah.
I was living in Tucson. Life.
Yeah.
Even though I was taking classes and stuff, I still hung out with kids from U of A, but it was because my roommate was a weed dealer, and so...
Sure, you got to stay in the loop.
In the loop. I'd go out and drink on Thursday nights with, like, people. Yeah. That was the big night, but mostly I would be at Laughs, trying to get guest sets on Fridays and Saturdays, and working at KFMA the rest of the time.
That's great. So you finished your degree?
I got my degree. I was starting to do the road stuff my senior year.
Like featuring?
I was featuring. I was emceeing at Laughs Albuquerque.
It's funny because I did one of my first paid gigs when I was a doorman at the comedy store. I went to Laughs. And I might have opened for Jeff Foxworthy before the redneck thing.
Because by the way, all those headshots were still up at Laughs. Sure. But I was there in 03, 04.
Yeah, I'm talking 04. 87.
So it was fun for us because 04, you're looking at the 87 headshots and you're going like, look at Foxworthy.
I know.
Yeah. You're like, look at Seinfeld.
Foxworthy with the mullet.
Oh my God. Yeah, and we would always, you know, I would stand there waiting to go up, just looking at it, being like, crazy these guys work there.
Oh, dude, you're going to the store tomorrow night?
Yeah, I'm at the store tomorrow night.
Yeah, look at that hallway.
I love it. That reminds me of Laughs. Every time I've been at the store, I'm like, oh man, look, this is like the Zanies in Nashville.
Again.
Very similar to Zanies in Chicago.
Yep.
They have all the old ones, and you're like, look at this motherfucker.
But those two have Killer Bees headshots.
Killer Bees, but save up. There's the reason they got that balcony. And now it's the Nate Bargatze balcony.
Yeah. Now but, Nate Bargatze, that whole town's Nate Bargatze.
Yeah, his whole face is on the
fucking
side.
Fucking murals on the wall.
Yeah, it's like Roadhouse. He's fucking running shit.
I can't be, it's so rare that I'm happy for a guy, but I'm certainly happy for him. He used to open for me.
Dude.
And I remember seeing him in Grand Rapids for the first time. And I met him in New York. I didn't know him in New York, but he was still kind of doughy and sweaty, and he was up in Grand Rapids, and I was like, who the fuck is this guy?
It was
and
the
I,
Laugh It Up Festival.
Yeah.
And you, because Nate's one of my best friends.
Oh, yeah.
And I, back in the day when he was doughy and sweaty, I was opening for him.
Right.
That was the road gigs I was getting.
Okay.
When Nate was doing C clubs.
Yeah.
And he was just my friend.
And I was just so taken with his.
And I remember specifically, he goes, dude, Mark Maron came up to me and was like, you're funny. and he was like, he watched both my shows. And I remember both of us being like, what? I was like, I knew Maron. I would talk to him, Air America, but it was after after this podcast exploded. And he's like, I mean, dude, he like, I'm at work with him. And I was like, dude, charmed life. Look, it was like, and now he's doing arenas and he's like the guy.
I know.
And it's so deserved and so loving. But you know, KFMA in doing Laughs got me ready, and then it kind of came to the point where I was like, well, you don't stay here. And I didn't like L.A.
Yeah.
I didn't like the energy
of L.A.
No, you
made the right call.
And I always, like I said, from growing up and loving Tough Crowd and all that stuff, I was like, and I remember being like, let me just see if I can hang. I just want to see if I can fucking hang with the big dogs in New York. And I moved there, and it was the greatest decision I ever made. It was some of the leanest years of my life, you know, with zero money.
But you had
money.
Like, what, 3-4 years under your belt of hammering it out?
I had 2.5 years. And then, so I kind of knew. But then I moved there and I went to like 3 mics and I was like, I got to rewrite everything.
Yeah.
I'm so road hacky.
Yeah.
You could just tell. I was like, I was doing things that were pandering to the crowd.
Sure.
And then I'm going to open mics and it's like Rory Scovel,
right.
Kumail just moved there, Jesse Pop. Like, I'm watching these guys that are like, I'm like, holy shit. Oh. And I'm coming up with...
Those are kind of lyrical guys. We weren't watching the punchies.
Like
Attell and Geraldo.
I would sneak into the cellar.
Yeah.
And that was...
That's where you...
That was the education.
That's like the boxing ring.
Yeah. I would go... I became friends with Big J.
Yeah.
I became friends with Big J Okerson, who's still this day one of my closest friends.
Yeah.
And he got me in with one of the door guys at the cellar, Shaq.
Yeah.
Who's passed away. Rest in peace. But Shaq would be like... I wasn't at the cellar, none of that. He just knew I was a comic, and he'd be like, all right, you can come in.
Right.
And he would sneak me into the little seats on the side.
Yeah, sure.
And I would watch Geraldo, Attell. One time I was watching Attell.
Yeah.
And as a desert rat, this blew my mind. This was before Louis came out.
Yeah.
So the cellar wasn't sold out every show.
No, I know. Yeah, it was like a weeknight, half-filled.
They would do one crowd for both shows. And then
just
the
one
leave.
Room.
Yeah. just the one room, yeah. and the crowd could leave, and more people would come in.
Right.
And it was ever-changing, but it was technically two shows. So I'm watching Attell on The Late Show, drinking a beer, just watching Attell, and someone sits now next to me with a full pitcher of beer, and I'm like, who's in Stanhope?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Doug Stanhope, yeah. who's one of my heroes. And I'm just like, what the fuck? And he's like hammered.
Yeah.
Doug.
Yeah.
Being real Doug.
Yeah.
And he's watching Attell, and he's like hitting me on my arm on Attell jokes, and I'm like, right? And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, I got to go sleep on a futon in Hoboken. This is so worth it. Yeah, it's yeah. so worth it just sure. to watch
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Stanhope lose it to Attell.
Oh, dude, I remember when I was working at the Improv in like the late 80s at the original Improv, and Hicks was living in town for, he lasted a few months. And, you know, we're hanging out in the bar in front of the Improv, and Brian Regan was going on.
Yeah.
And Hicks is like, gotta go watch Regan.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And
I geek out so yeah. few often.
We're sitting
anymore,
in the back of the Improv. There's hardly anyone there. And Hicks is just loving Regan. Loves
I love
Regan.
It. Yeah. Because Regan's the yeah. one of the oh, greatest, yeah. the I mean, best. Yeah, the yeah. funniest of all time. And Hicks, obviously legendary.
Yeah. yeah. But just so different.
So different.
But it's like me. Like, I like watching Goofy Guy. I love Nate.
I am.
You know, it's like, I'm not callous. Yeah. People can get in.
I
you
love
know?
It, though. Yeah, yeah. I love Hicks being like, ah, stubbing out a cigarette. I gotta go watch Regan.
I gotta go watch Regan. Totally.
Let's fucking go. Totally. I love it so much.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Rant in E Minor is just as important to me as I Walked on the Moon.
Of course.
Like,
yeah.
they're like those two
yeah,
albums yeah. where you're like, I
That's
just love
it. The full spectrum. The
yeah.
full spectrum.
But it, you know, moving to New York, and then I had no money, and I was waiting tables, and I got hired. Rob Cross, who used to be the operations manager of K-Rock, and he was like, the man at KFMA, the one in Tucson, was now at Sirius because he went there with Howard
right.
in 05.
Right.
And I reached out to him. I was like, hey, man, former KFMA, Desert Rat, I'm in the city, I'm doing stand-up.
Yeah.
If you need to hire anybody. And he was like, I don't know, come by Sirius. Come to Sirius and talk to me.
Yeah.
And so I talked to him. And he's like, listen, we're having a hiring freeze right now. I remember him specifically going, it's an EEO hiring freeze. I was like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But he's like, but, you know, you can do production and stuff. I'll let people know.
Yeah.
And then I got a call from Danny at, she worked at Free FM.
Yeah.
Which was the old K-Rock.
Yeah.
And she's like, we're doing rock music on the weekends.
Yeah.
Do you want to come in and maybe do some, like, get back on air? And
yeah.
Like, abso-fucking-lutely.
Yeah.
And I went in and I got a job, and it was union.
Yeah.
So I was getting good money.
Oh, great.
Like 250 a shift.
Yeah.
And I would just work whenever someone would call out.
Yeah.
I would be there.
Yeah.
And I saved up, and that's how I got the place in Astoria to rent. And I worked at K-Rock. And then I was doing stand-up, but also working at K-Rock on, like, because it switched back from Free FM to WXRK, K-Rock. And I would give Nate shout-outs on the radio. They'd be driving back from, like, one-nighters.
Yeah.
And Big J would be like, hey, are you working at K-Rock? I'd be like, yeah, who are you with?
Yeah.
He'd be like, Justin, and all these people are like, hey, Jay and Justin are driving back right now from a gig. You know,
they'd be like,
ah, and it was, the radio was still cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, you were at Air America.
Yeah.
And then that's what leads us when you got let go. I think like a month later I was let go.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing you at Eastville, and I was like, all right, I have something to talk to him about. And I remember walking up to you being like, you know, I know you got fired at Air America. I just got fired from CBS Radio. And you were like, oh, man. And you were just like, what the fuck? And you were really, you know, it was before you had this. It
sure.
was before you.
I was a pretty shattered guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember you being like, man, fuck them.
Yeah.
What is this shit? Radio's dying. And I was like, yeah, Marc Maron. And I knew you, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew about you well. I'd listened to your album. So I was like, yeah, man. Fucking radio, right? And I'm drinking a beer. But it was such like, you know, little kids when they follow adults and they like see an adult do something. So that was me doing that to you.
Yeah,
where I was like, right,
locked right into the crankiness.
Look at us trying to be funny, and they're not letting us.
Yeah,
and you were like, man, I'm going to California, and I was like, oh, that's awesome.
So I was already shattered. I'd gotten through the divorce, and I came back and started this in 2009.
Yeah,
and you just hammered it out.
Yeah,
and here we are, full circle.
It was crazy, and it was like. You know, then I got fired. When I got fired from K-Rock, I was like, well.
All in,
man. Yeah. Let's just do, and I would just wait tables during the day and just do stand-up at night. And then was lucky, and I got Montreal, and that led to a manager that got me a gig that I could leave, you know, waiting tables. And it's just been like.
And you're doing some acting now?
Yeah, I did some acting. I was on the show Billions, which is wrapping it, which is over. It's
the
final season
You
right
like
now.
The acting?
I do. I don't. Like the pursuit of roles.
Me neither, and I don't like the waiting either.
Neither do I.
It's
Big J, that was Big J's biggest problem.
Yeah.
Because what's funny is how I got back to radio.
Yeah.
Podcasts were blowing up.
Yeah.
And I didn't have one. And Big J, who's always been one of my closest friends, and his girlfriend, Christine, we were outside smoking cigarettes at the Cellar one night. She's like, why don't you guys do a podcast?
Yeah.
You guys are always joking around and riffing. And I was like, yeah, let's try it. So I bought all the stuff.
Yeah.
And
what was it called?
Well, we didn't have a name for it.
Yeah.
We were recording it in Queens under the train.
Yeah.
So we're going to call it the Under the Train podcast.
Right.
But we didn't have anything. And then Attell was doing a show for Comedy Central called Attell from the Underground. Or it was like, it was Attell and all of his favorite New York comics. And I was there watching Jay tape his set. And one of the guys from Comedy Central was like, asking about what I was doing. And I was like, oh, Jay and I have 8 practice episodes of a podcast. And he was like, Don't release those. He's like, can I hear a couple of them?
Yeah.
This guy, Steve, we called him Cool Dad. And I was like, yeah, I'll give it to you. And so Dave Kimowitz, the late, great Dave Kimowitz, who was Jay's manager who passed away, he did like a sizzle reel.
Yeah.
And he gave it to him, and they loved it. And Sirius had been reaching out to me about doing something because I had been on Opie and Anthony a lot.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, we kind of want to figure something out for you. They were trying to get me in somehow. And then with this tape, Comedy Central was a little more excited.
Yeah.
And we went to Sirius and they were like, their first idea was for me to host a clip show.
Right. No.
Where I'd play stand-up clips.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I said, no, have me and Jay fuck around.
Yeah.
And they're like, maybe in a couple months.
Right.
We could have Jay come on as a guest. I was like, no.
This is the show.
I said this in a boardroom, which as a former radio guy, you'll love.
Yeah.
I said, why do radio people do this all the time? I said, get the fuck out of the way.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I said.
Yeah, yeah.
And my manager, Brian Stern, was like, all right, I don't know if I'd say it like that. But I go, get out of the way. Yeah. Just get out of the way and try it.
Yeah. What do you got to do? You got 900 stations.
Yeah. So they gave us 6 test episodes.
Yeah.
And Jay and I did it, and it became The Bonfire.
Right.
And then we did The Bonfire, which grew to 4 days a week. Which we did for 8 years.
Yeah.
And I was back in radio.
Yeah.
But on my terms.
Yeah, it's great.
In a place at Sirius that didn't have an EEO hiring freeze when I got hired.
Now, did you pull an audience?
It was great.
Yeah.
Best fans. And they've stuck. I left in March. I stepped away from the show and Bobby Kelly took over for me.
All right.
Because Big J, the entire time we made the show, I was leery of radio, as we've just explained.
Sure.
I was kind of over it after I got fired from K-Rock.
Yeah, and everything, the whole landscape's changing. Yeah.
And I just didn't want to be in radio.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a sweet tooth for
it. Yeah, yeah.
And Jay loves broadcasting.
Yeah.
He's great at it.
Yeah.
And he was like, I want to do the show. And I kept being like, I'm only doing this for a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
I made that clear from the beginning. I was like, hey, I don't want to do this forever.
Yeah.
And Jay was like, I do. And I was like, well, let's build this show and then I'll bail when I feel necessary.
Right.
Thinking 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And we went 8.
8 years.
But it got us through the pandemic.
Sure.
And Big J's one of the funniest human beings I've ever been around.
Yeah, he's great.
In my life.
Yeah, I always loved him.
Yeah.
So now you're just on the road.
Now I'm just doing stand-up.
And how's the draw? Good?
It's great.
Oh, good.
Bonfire fans are still coming out.
Yeah.
Billions fans.
And I noticed you're touring, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to start a podcast in October or November. Just a 30-minute one-on-one.
On your own terms.
On my own terms.
Yeah.
Come and hang out.
Yeah.
We're just going to bullshit about whatever
All
you
right.
feel like.
Well, I'll come do it.
Yeah, I would love that. Right. I would fucking blow my mind to have Mark Maron.
Yeah, he's kind of, you know,
but it's like
hang
cyclical.
Out. Yeah, yeah.
But it's, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Come recreate that Eastville hang.
Yeah, we've
bar.
Gotten all the way full circle in this conversation back to Eastville, and now your trajectory. Now I'll come to your podcast, and then the world will end.
And then it's all, we're all, the simulation keeps fucking recycling.
But what's the website? Because I know you got a lot of dates coming up.
DanSoder.com. They're all up there.
Yeah, great talking to you, man.
Man, this was, out of all the interviews I've listened to, you know, the Robin Williams,
sure.
the Josh Homme, the Obama.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this was real cool, man.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
I thought you were going to say, like, this was going to be the best interview.
No. I actually felt bad. I felt like the entire time, I'm like, I got too sad at one point. I should have been funnier.
No.
Yeah.
That sadness was legitimate.
Oh, it was 100%.
And you know how this show works. We're not looking for laughs all the time. I'll turn you to sadness.
One of my favorite moments was Louis choking up about talking about his daughter being born.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Boy. I wish, what are you going to do?
You guys got to run that back.
We'll see. I'll talk to you later.
Later.
There you go. Dan Soder. His tour dates and ticket links are at dansoder.com. Hang out for a minute, people.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
4 years ago this week, I had a great chat here in the garage with the one and only John Goodman. You can go listen to that right now in whatever app you're using to listen to this episode.
You know, it's like when you finally get that clarity and you're feeling, you know, relatively comfortable in your own skin. I mean, the worst thing about it is that, you know, that's it. That's all there is.
Yeah.
that's the hardest thing to accept.
But I didn't know that for 30 years.
Right, right, right.
And it took me a long time to just, okay, this is all right.
Yeah.
And when I look around, it's better than all right. It's pretty good.
It's good. The gratitude element is always the missing factor when you're hard on yourself, you know, because I'm just sort of like, fuck it. You know, what the fuck? What's the fucking point? I'm an asshole. And then you know, if you're able to manage it, which I'm not great at, you know, it's okay.
Well, I figure nobody owes me a thing.
Right.
So take care of yourself.
Right. Nobody owes you anything. But that doesn't mean there's not a world full of assholes out there.
Oh, yeah. And mostly you have to laugh at them.
Yeah. Well, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to sort of my thing is I get into a thing where like, that guy's an asshole. Why am I not more like him?
Yeah. He's successful.
Yeah, exactly. To get all WTF episodes ad-free, sign up for WTF Plus by going to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. All right. Okay. Guitar time. Frankie and LaFonda, Cat Angels everywhere.